Sorry. My name's Michael. I'm a female alcoholic. And it really is a privilege to be here. I heard you don't have very much time to talk, and I hope I can keep it. I mean, when you're used to talking at conventions, your talk is your talk. So I hope to keep it short. Anyway, I just want to share with you. My husband and I have taken 3 falls this month. I took 2 and he took 1. And it's all because of our dogs. We have a lot of dogs. We rescue animals. And anyway, I took this fall and I hit my head. I have a scar. Everything swelled up. I was blacked down here and I had to go to a convention the next day. And I broke a rib. And then my husband fell the following week and he broke a hip. And I'm looking all over for him. The dogs are in the yard. I'm looking all over for him. And I can't find him. And all of a sudden, I just walked a little further. And there was my husband laying across the street. He's across the street laying with his head in the lap of the most beautiful woman I have ever seen. And I just didn't know what to think or what to say. And I just went, hey, what are you doing across the street? And what happened, I didn't notice she had a dog, and our 3 dogs went after her dog, and he went after our dogs and grabbed one, and it got away, and he slipped and he fell back and he broke his hip. So anyway, and then I took a fall in the market just a few days ago. Somebody hit me in the back with their cart, and I was stepping back anyway, and boom. And there is nothing like laying there on the floor with a big knot on your head and all these heads are staring at you. You know, it was just so freaky. But we work with the soldiers in Augusta. Every Wednesday night we have about 30 soldiers that are trying to recover from alcoholism in our home. And it's just a gift. I've been doing it for 18 years. But we were closing with the Serenity Prayer. And we always say the we version of the Serenity Prayer because it's a we program. And there's so many people, we can't hold hands. We have to put our arms around each other. And so I've got my arm around this soldier. And this soldier was 6'8". And my hand hit his butt. And I went, oh, I am so sorry. But that's right where his butt was where, where a waist would be. So my husband says, now we're even. all this stuff is just life on life's terms, but we have a lot of fun with it. And you know, when I crawled through these doors of Alcoholics Anonymous over 35 years ago, I had a formal 9th grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare, and I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. And all of that was before I took that first drink at the age of 25. I always swore I was not going to be an alcoholic like my mom. And I managed not to drink for 25 years. But I did all the things she did without that drink. My mom really did want to recover from the disease of alcoholism. I really wanted to recover from the disease of alcoholism. So we did a lot of things like geographic, psychiatrists, church. I remember I went to the same psychiatrist she went to, but it was at different times. And the one thing about the psychiatrist is my mom slept with him. That was her deal. She was sleeping with the psychiatrist. And we both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort, different times in different congregations. The result was about the same as my mom because I was sleeping with the minister. And I think we drove these 2 men to drink, honestly, honest to God, truth. But the neat thing about these 2 men is today they're both sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that just goes to show you that alcoholics works when other things fail. A little bit about my background. I'm Irish, German, and Cherokee, and I'm illegitimate, and being born out of wedlock today is just not a big deal. But when I was a little girl growing up, it was a big deal. And they called you certain names, and it was very hard to live with this stigma. My mom later after, well, first of all, my mom's an alcoholic, And when my mom was 13 years old, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. And her father was in a chain gang. So that left my mom out on the streets at the age of 13 trying to raise herself. So at the age of 14, she had her first baby, which she gave up for adoption. And then she had me, and she did everything in her power to keep me. She later met this man, got married. We all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce. And my stepfather moved back to Colorado. So that left my mother in California trying to raise four little kids. We were raised on welfare. We were raised in extreme, extreme poverty, always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, always being evicted, even having to sleep in cars. And then I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism, I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with all of her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again, and this time she sent my three younger brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my three brothers are my very best friends. When you're sleeping in cars, you're always being evicted. You don't have an opportunity to make friends, so my brothers were my friends. And I feel like at the age of 12, I had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those were feelings of low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all that poverty. That drunken psychiatrist pointed out to me that I had issues of abandonment. You know, I never knew my real dad. My stepdad went away. My three brothers went away. My mom's always trying to kill herself. And because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I have always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the two very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, first, I learned that feelings are not facts. All those things I used to think about myself were not the truth. And best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And this last 20, 22 years, I've walked through two of my biggest fears. And one of them was getting here at the podium and telling you my story. I just couldn't do it. I never shared my story till I was 11 years sober. 4 years of sobriety, I couldn't read how it works at the podium. My sponsor just was always on me. She wanted me to start sharing at the podium because she respected my sobriety, and I'd bring out the big book. Okay, where in here does it talk about speaking? You know, and I got away with it for quite a while. But one day she was really sick with pneumonia, and she had an engagement, and she talked me into going into her place, and somehow I was just drop-kicked into this speaking thing and getting on airplanes. My biggest fear of all was getting on airplanes. And you know, I found out today that I'm really not afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. My sponsor told me I better be clear of what my fear was when I'm asking God to remove it. But I hear things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not in the big book, and they can confuse a newcomer. It's not bad or good. It's their experience, strength, and hope. But the one thing I used to hear is that you could not have fear and faith at the same time. That if you had fear, you didn't have any faith. And I had worked these steps as hard as I could work these steps. And I've had spiritual experiences. But I still had all this overwhelming fear. And I went up to one of these gurus in our Long Beach area. And I asked him, I said, why do I still have all this fear? And he told me in the most arrogant, smug way, he said, well, it sounds to me like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Today, I know I had taken a thorough third step. To me, the third step is a process. A thorough third step is a process. And that process for me is taking the actions of 4 through 9. Until I've done that, my third step isn't thorough. But anyway, so I went over to a man who was so instrumental in my sobriety. And I was crying on his shoulder. I think I was trying to tattle on this other guy. And I said, he said, I haven't taken a thorough third step because I'm still afraid. And basically what Bill told me is, he said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it tell you you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to page 68, and it's under the fear inventory. And he pointed out a sentence to me, and that sentence says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me, you don't need courage unless you're afraid. And then he took me down to the bottom of that prayer, and it gives you that little fear prayer. God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I'm always directed to work with another person. whether they're in the program or out of the program. And that last sentence in that paragraph says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. It does not say at once we outgrow fear. It says we commence to outgrow fear. So I can tell you today I'm 35 years sober and I'm still commencing. But it's okay, because today I'm willing to walk through that fear. The first 10 years of sobriety, I was not. It paralyzed me. I want to tell you about my first experience having to fly, speaking at a convention, and I take really to heart an AA commitment. And this girl was going to take me to the airport, boot me on the plane, and she had an emergency, so she just had to drop me. I'm in California at LAX, and 6 o'clock in the morning, and she just has to drop me off, and I'm standing there in the ticket area, and I just started to have a panic attack. I had terrible panic attacks where my legs would shake so bad they would go out from under me, and I'd hyperventilate and I'd break out into a sweat, and I just knew I couldn't keep this commitment, and I fell back into the chair. And when I fell back into that chair, I started crying, which for me is good because it helps relieve that panic. And at that point, I had one of the spiritual experiences. I had an inner voice talk to me. It was loud and it was clear, but it wasn't through the ears. And it said, Michael, why don't you get out of yourself and try and help somebody? And it was just so shocking to me. I'm going, what? This isn't an AA meeting. And then I noticed at the escalator, there were all these little old ladies struggling with their bags, trying. That's how you got up to the planes. You took the escalator, unless you could find an elevator, which was almost impossible. So I ran over there and started helping these little ladies with their bags, getting them up to the plane. And it was so successful. I mean, it really took me out of myself. And every time I had to fly, I would report to the escalator like I worked there. One day, a woman hit me with her purse. She thought I was trying to take her bag or something. That was a little bit embarrassing. But the one thing I do when we're in turbulence, real bad turbulence, and you can't jump up and say, let me help somebody, I always carry pen and paper with me, and I pull it out and I start writing the names of people that I know are struggling, and I put them in the third step prayer. So I'll write out, God, I offer Bev to thee to do with her as thou wilt. Relieve her of the bondage of self that she may better do thy will. So I have pages and pages and pages of the third step prayer when we land, but we've always landed. And it amazes me, planes really do fly. I used to think they crashed more than they flied. I don't know why. I did have a friend, you know, after doing inventory and stuff comes up, I had a friend die in the Canary Islands crash. I don't know if any of you remember that crash. Two planes, they collided on the runway. And so I'm sure that had a lot to do with my fear. But anyway, you know, in step 10, it says we're to continue watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. It's not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Wow, that was a big relief for me, you know, because it's right there in the book in step 10 that it might continue for a lifetime. And then it's reiterated again in step 11 on retiring at night. It's the very first question, and this is supposed to be an inventory. I can't even think of the word right now. I took two falls on my head, so if you can think of the word for me, just throw it out there. anyway, the very first question says, were you selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid? Do you owe an apology? Have you kept something to yourself that you should share with another person? And then it asks about the good things. It says, have you been packing into the mainstream of life? And anybody sitting in a meeting is packing into the mainstream of life. At least you're not out there right now doing what you used to do. Were you kind and loving towards all? If I was kind and loving towards 90%, I give myself credit, because there's a time I wouldn't have. I'd focus on that 10%. And then it has that thing at the bottom, and it says, we must be careful not to drift in worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. for that diminishes our usefulness to others. So that means once you've done that work, and that is how I do my step 10, even though it's under step 11, that's how I do my step 10. I answer those questions and I do it in writing because I did my fourth step in writing. And that's just what works for me. And that helps me stay out of that remorse and morbid reflection. So anyway, I'm 13 years old now and my mom has this baby. And I have to learn how to be a mom, and I don't even know how to be a kid. My mom's alcoholism took her out of the home. She was never around, and I had full responsibility of this little baby. This little baby is sleeping in a dresser drawer. I eventually had to potty train her, bottle break her. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. After doing my inventory, I found out the truth was I hated school anyway. When I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers, or I was teased about the way I dressed and teased about my hair. And so specifically to get out of my home life at the age of 15, I got married. And the man I married was 18. He lived in the neighborhood. He came from a similar background. And I have such a colorful past that I like to brag about this. I want everyone here to know when I got married at the age of 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values. I really did. I had these ridiculous TV shows that were my very favorite programs, and they were family shows. Most of you are too young to know what these shows are. But it was Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. And you should have seen Donna Reed. Oh, my gosh. She was just something else. And she would wear these big, beautiful dresses with all these petticoats and these 4-inch heels. And that was her vacuuming attire. That's how she vacuumed the house. So when I got married at the age of 15, I had this wild idea that I was Miss Donna Reed, marry Mr. Father Knows Best. And unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. And I believe the man I married was an alcoholic. One indication, his name was Johnny Walker. Think I would have had a clue, but I hadn't taken a drink yet. I want to share a story with you about that sister of mine, because she came from the very same background that I came from. Illegitimate, dealing with my mom's alcoholism. She was forced to move out of the house at the age of 16, so she quit school and she moved out. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test, and she had to take it 3 times until she finally passed it. Well, with this test under her belt, under a special youth program, she went to work for the city of Long Beach. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her 10 years retirement pay and bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer for the city of Long Beach, and they're still married. And at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. Even today, sometimes I still don't get it. You know, same mom, same background, but different reactions. And the difference is my sister is not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today, I get to accept responsibility. I can no longer blame all those people, places, and things. Yes, I am an alcoholic and I do have a disease. But today, I have a solution, and a big part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions and my present actions. So, at the age of 15, I got married. At the age of 17, I had a baby. At the age of 18, I had to get out of this marriage because this man took me through a whole new phase of alcoholism I never experienced with my mom, and it's called physical abuse. And he never abused me unless he was drinking. But he abused me to the point of cutting me up with a knife, and I had to have surgery to repair the damage. So I got out of that marriage at the age of 18, and I feel like that's when I started on the road of being everything I swore I'd never be, doing everything I swore I'd never do. Hadn't even took a drink of alcohol yet, but I always intuitively knew if I took a drink of alcohol, I'd be an alcoholic. But it started out with me being a single mother living on welfare. My whole life growing up, I swore when I grew up I wasn't going to live like that. And there I was. On page 23 in the big book, it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So it's telling us that our main problem is the mental obsession and not the physical allergy. So I know for me, I practiced my disease of alcoholism way before I ever took that first drink. And I did it in the form of compulsive overeating. I would shove food in my mouth instead of alcohol. And then I discovered that wonderful world of diet pills. And this is back when diet doctors gave you really good pharmaceutical methadrine. And boy, that was some good stuff. I'm telling you, I was thin and my house was clean. And then it turns on you. So I went on a diet for 16 years. When I finally took that drink at the age of 25, I immediately had that physical allergy. From the very first drink, I had the phenomenon of craving. From the very first drink, I had a personality change. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you read about that in the Big Book. The Big Book refers to that as a real alcoholic. And I personally am so physically allergic to alcohol. When I consume alcohol, I break out in a rash, welts, and hives all over my body. And I was always too drunk to have a clue that that wasn't normal. And if I'd had a clue, it wouldn't have made a difference. But from that very first drink, I drank morning, noon, and night, and I did not draw a sober breath from the age of 25 to the age of 31. And this is not an exaggeration. I had a huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program, and this was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. In the Big Book, it says, as a result of spiritual awakening, you'll have a change in psyche, a change in attitude. It says you'll have this huge emotional displacement rearrangement. And this spiritual experience I had was not enough for me to do that. And I believe it's because I did not have a plan of action to go with it. But it was enough for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So what I did with this experience is I sought out a very specific church. I counseled with the minister. I told him all about my spiritual experience. I shared with him all my character defects and all my shortcomings. This man assured me if I got really active in this church, I read all these inspirational books, and I did all this positive thinking and affirmations, that I could be everything that I ever wanted to be. After I got to this program, I heard a speaker at the podium say, if you're alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I'm absolute proof of that, because I got really active in that church, and I became the secretary of the church. And I struggled reading those books, and I did all that positive thinking and affirmations, and the only thing that resulted is I ended up having a torrid affair with this minister, and it absolutely infuriated his wife. And the rest of the congregation wasn't too excited about it either. Well, they were excited, but it wasn't the right kind of excited. I want to share two stories with you while I'm on the subject of the minister. I like to share this first story because it's the first time I was ever able to laugh at any part of my alcoholism. When I got sober, in California, it's very theatrical, and we have funny, funny speakers. And they would speak, and everybody in the room would laugh. And at first, I was incapable of laughing. I could not laugh, and I didn't think any of it was funny. And this went on for about 2 years. I just couldn't laugh. And then one day, a speaker got up and shared something, and I just burst into this huge belly laugh. It's the first time I've ever laughed like that. But right after having that laugh, I found myself thinking, well, that might be funny for you. But there's nothing, absolutely nothing in my background I could ever laugh at. And then about 22 years ago, it's just my second time to ever give an AA talk. Oh, God, was the first one depressing. Oh, it was so depressing. I went home and I told God, if you want me to do this in AA, you're going to have to lighten up my story. Or I might kill myself. And what happened is the second time I had to share my story, my daughter was trying to get sober one more time. She got sober when she was 15, and at the age of 18, she and her girlfriend were leaving an AA dance, and a man came up to them with a gun and kidnapped these two girls. Knocked the one girl unconscious and brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours. And at the point where she knew he was going to kill her anyway, and it took her a long time to remember. She did say a quiet prayer to live. When he was forcing her into the trunk of the car, and he had a bottle of alcohol in his pocket that he drank throughout the whole ordeal, thank God, because he got quite drunk. And he's forcing her into the trunk of the car, and somehow my daughter just got the courage to make some kind of an effort to save her own life. And she just swung around and got him in the face with her elbow. He went down, the gun slid under the car. She ran down the street naked and got away. And later on, he rolled the other girl out into the street. So both girls lived. But the road of recovery was really hard, and it was really long. And my daughter and I absolutely felt betrayed. How could God let something like this happen to us? We were both sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How could God let something like this happen to us? This is a spiritual program, and we were working as hard as we could. But the hardest thing for me to deal with was a sentence in the Big Book, and I'll close with that story. It used to be 449. Now it's on, what is it on? 477? 417. And it says, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. So I think I've got the disease of perception, so I perceive that to mean if nothing in God's world happens by mistake, then that had to be an act of God. I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God. I didn't want any part of a God that acted like that. And that man, Bill Honeycutt, that helped me with fear, took me by the hand, and he said, Michael, God is good, and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. He said, man has free will. That man was acting on his free will, and your daughter was just a victim. He said, if man didn't have free will, we wouldn't all be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all be perfect people. And when he told me that, I had this huge spiritual release. And I knew he was telling me the truth, and I came to terms with my God again. But I still had so much trouble with that sentence in the Big Book. But anyway, my daughter lost her sobriety over the rape. And I don't know if any of you know what it's like to have to kick your child out of the house. She's 18 sober and gets raped, and now she's drinking and using. And I just want to stay sober, and I have to kick her out after what already happened to her. It's the hardest thing I ever did. But so she tried over and over to get sober, and she just couldn't, because people were always forcing forgiveness. You have to forgive your perpetrator. You have to forgive your perpetrator. It's very hard to forgive something like that. And what I learned over the years is all you have to do is be willing. Be willing, and it'll happen in God's time. And it took 9 years for that to happen to my daughter. But when it happened, she looked like she had a facelift. She was a different person. But anyway, so she's trying to get sober again when I'm giving my second AA talk. And she brings all of her program girlfriends over to my house. We're sitting down, we're having coffee. And if anything makes you laugh, she gave it to me that night. And that's why I keep it in my story. But she's telling her girlfriends my drunkalog. And she's telling the girls all about the minister. I never thought about how some of this stuff looks through the eyes of a little 9-year-old. She was 9 years old. And I'm seeing this minister. And she comes home from school at 3:00 in the afternoon. And she opens the bedroom door. And there, naked in bed with her mom, was the married minister of the church. When she first said this, I just had all these appropriate feelings. I felt embarrassment. I felt shame. I felt compassion for her. I just felt all these feelings. And I looked at her and I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. I'm sorry, I used to cry at this part, and now I laugh. I don't know why. The years change things. Anyway, she looked at me and she said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me the most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. Up until that time, I forgot he had an artificial leg. It was a huge leg. I don't know how you could forget it. But in ways that were important, he was not disabled. This is where I get a hot flash. So, step 9, besides step 12, is my favorite step. I call step 9 the freedom step. This is the step that truly freed me from the bondage of my past. And it's just not a coincidence that in the Big Book, those promises come after step 9. It says before you're halfway through, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. it says you won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to wait to get halfway through step 9, thank God, because it took me 12 years to finish my list of amends. That happened to me with my very first amends, and I was going back to that church and telling that minister I used to steal from the church funds. And he told me he knew that. Then I had to tell him I used to steal out of his wallet when he was in the shower, and he told me he did not know that. So I set up a payment schedule to pay him back and to pay the church back. I was never able to pay anything in a lump sum. I had to set up payment schedules. So I'm making these amends to him, and he told me at that time, by the time I got to him, he knew exactly what I was doing. By the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his leg in that motorcycle accident, he was a drug addict and an alcoholic, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience, and that's what led him into ministerial school and becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober in church. And I'm not putting down churches, and I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort, because I know people who have gotten sober that way. I just feel like if you get sober in AA, this is where God wants you to do your work. At least that's where I feel God wants me to do my work. So, I get kicked out of this church. I'm 27 years old. I'm full on into my drinking. Live in an apartment I'm being evicted from. This is my normal MO. Lights, gas had been turned off for a long time, but I still had a telephone. It was a working priority. I got this call at 11 o'clock at night, and I could not believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was my real dad. And he wanted to make amends for not being in my life. He wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter. So he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know his whole family. And I didn't want to go, and I didn't have any desire to get to know him, because I really did love my stepdad. But I didn't, and I really didn't want to move to the snow, but I didn't have anywhere to go except for out on the streets. And I think deep down inside I had this little hope, if I did this geographic, maybe I could change. So I made that move to Colorado, and I lived there for 3 months, and in that 3 month period, I ended up having affairs with the bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having an abortion, falling down the stairs and breaking my leg, ripping off his medicine cabinet, ripping off his booze cabinet, and ripping off his money. So they literally kicked me out of the state of Colorado. I'm going to tell you how I broke that leg, obviously. I probably shouldn't because of time, but I just think it's funny now. I didn't think it was funny then, but I'm drunk. The liquor stores close at 12. I don't have a car, so I have to make my final liquor run. My daughter's on the left side of me trying to hold me up because I lived in a second floor apartment, and I'm walking down the stairs. She's trying to hold me up. And all of a sudden, I looked up at this second floor apartment that was directly in front of me, and out of that door walked a priest. I don't know what he was doing there. Maybe he was like my minister. But he had the collar, the robe. He's definitely a man of God. And I'm angry at God. I'm angry at God because I just seduced his minister and ripped off his church. So now I'm mad at God. And I looked up at that priest. I let go of the railing with my right hand. I flipped up my middle finger and I said, F you, God. And I immediately fell down the stairs and broke my leg. That, my daughter told me that's the day she started believing in a punishing God. Today we know it had nothing to do with God. I fell because I was drunk. But my real dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. And I wrote him a letter, and I told him I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. And I sent him a check trying to set up a payment schedule to pay him back. Basically, what he and the family did is they sent me the check back with a little note that said they didn't want my money and they never wanted to hear from me again. I was working with a sponsor, so of course I stayed sober, but I really did want to make these amends. And with my sponsor's encouragement, on every birthday and on every Father's Day, I would send him an appropriate card. I would take the actions of acting like a good daughter. And every card I sent, I would say, I still want to make restitution for my behavior up there. I did this for 6 or 7, 8, I don't know how many years I did this. But the last time I sent off a card, within a few days, I got something back in the mail that had his return address on it. And I was so excited, I cannot tell you how excited I was. And I ripped open that envelope, and the only thing that was in it was a picture of his tombstone and the obituary out of the newspaper. He just died. And that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't, but I took it real, real hard. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me, I don't make amends for approval. The Big Book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that those actions I took worked. Because not once, not even once, was I ever tempted to drink over that rejection. I'm just so sorry he didn't get to know the person I am today, because I knew he would have really been proud. So I've been kicked out of this church, and I'm kicked out of a state. I'm living back in Long Beach, California, across the street from Franklin Junior High, Franklin Junior High's a gang-related school. My daughter's now 14 years old, and she's running with an awful gang. I'm doing awful, humiliating, embarrassing things to my daughter, but I was not only embarrassing my daughter, I was embarrassing this entire gang. I lived in an apartment, being evicted from lights, gas, and telephone. It had all been turned off for a long time. Kept my drapes closed because my landlord was trying to serve me an eviction notice. And with the drapes closed because they were real thick, my apartment is dark, day and night. It is dark. It is so dark that now I'm seeing evil spirits. And unless you've seen them, they're hard to describe. But these evil spirits would do things like follow me around the house. And then I, in turn, would do things like crawl out of the house on my hands and knees, butt naked, across the street to the school ground and warn my daughter and her friends not to come home. The house is possessed with evil spirits. And that's the kind of stuff that makes me wish to God I was a blackout drinker. But I am not a blackout drinker. I get to remember that stuff, and all I can say is thank God it was the back of the school and not the front of the school. All the neighbors felt sorry for my daughter. They would feed her. Sometimes they'd hide her out. Sometimes they'd feed both of us. Once we were next door at the neighbor's house, she was fixing dinner for her family and invited us. And on her counter, she had a bottle of 100-proof vodka. I didn't know vodka came in 100-proof. I thought it was just 80-proof, you know, so I was quite impressed with it. And I was always promising my daughter I wouldn't drink. Something happened outside, a car accident or something. My neighbor and my daughter went to check it out, and I lagged behind because I just wanted to get some of that vodka down, drink it real fast, and not get caught. And I don't know how much I drank. I don't know how fast I drank it, but I do know it was enough to stop my respiratory system. And I can remember the sensation I couldn't breathe, and that's the last thing I remember. I don't remember the paramedics. I don't remember being rushed to the hospital. I don't remember being brought back to life. By the time I had any memory, I woke up and both my arms were strapped down to a hospital bed, and a nurse had just slapped me in the face because I was a pretty vile alcoholic. I was spitting at her and trying to bite her, and you know, a few things like that that might get you slapped. But this experience got my attention. This time I almost died under the influence of alcohol, and it scared me. I didn't want to die out there, and the real reason why I didn't want to die out there is I didn't want to do to my daughter. I didn't want her to experience all the things I had experienced as a child. So I tried really hard to quit drinking. My daughter would tell me on a daily basis, she said, Mom, it's the alcohol, and if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things. She said, just smoke pot. So this is my only experience smoking pot. But I'm trying not to drink, you know, so I smoked this pot with my daughter and her gang friends, and afterwards we're walking down the street, and I have on these tight, tight jeans, and I have my hands shoved down in my pockets. And I don't know if I tripped over a crack or my own foot, but I tripped, and I just started to go down. I don't know if any of you have been on pot, but for me it was different. First of all, I had the feeling I was in slow motion. I had the sensation that the cement was coming up at my face. And no matter what I did, I could not get my hands out of my pockets. So you got to picture a grown woman laying with her hands still in her pockets, her face is smashed in the cement, and all those gang members were laughing hysterically. They were absolutely hysterical. I know I wasn't laughing. But I could hear their laughter, and as I heard that laughter, I had that moment of clarity. I knew right then and there, beyond a shadow of a doubt, pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking. And I drank at the same pace for a while longer. But what finally happened for me is I reached a point you read about in the Big Book. And it's on page 151. It talks about facing those hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I woke up one more time on my front room floor, naked, in a puddle of fluid. Don't know what the fluid was. I took the first three steps, and I didn't even know what the first three steps were. But I knew I was powerless over alcohol, and my life had never been manageable. And I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just knew he wouldn't because of what I'd done to the church. And this was my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, as I just got on my knees. And I said, God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please, please just get me sober. And it's a good thing I said, I don't care how you do it, because the one thing I would not have done is come to AA. My mom was in and out of AA. She proved to me it didn't work. She ran around with a lot of sleazy men. They're sleazy women, too. People come in here to hook up, not to get sober. And those are the kind of people my mom hung with. And I was about 12 years old, and two of these men made very serious passes at me. So that's what I thought about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our actions out there are very important, because we might be the only copy of a big book someone comes in contact with. So the mayor of Signal Hill was in AA, and he was driving past my mom's house and remembered her from years ago when she was in AA. So he stopped to try and talk her into a meeting. I went to her house because I was starting to go through DTs and I didn't know what to do. And he tried to talk her into going to a meeting. She wouldn't go. So he started on me. And it didn't take very much, and he was very kind, and he treated me with a lot of dignity. And he talked me into going to that meeting that night. I went to that meeting, and he and another gentleman had me wait in the parking lot. They ran across the street, and they bought two beers. They came back, and they made me drink them. I thought, oh, it's not too bad. No, seriously, it did exactly what they wanted it to do. It stopped the DTs, and I was able to listen at the meeting. And there was a woman there that just shared my story, and I've never heard anybody share it since. She said that she didn't drink till later on in life, but she practiced her disease of alcoholism way before she ever drank, and she did it in the form of compulsive overeating and amphetamine abuse. But the one thing she said, and this is the real reason why I stayed, she said, some kids want to be doctors. Some kids want to be lawyers. And all she ever wanted to do when she grew up was just not to be an alcoholic like her mom. And I just started to cry, and I couldn't stop, and I cried throughout the rest of the meeting. And I was so physically sick that week, I couldn't, well, I did get to a meeting Sunday morning, but somebody had to take me home because I was violently throwing up, and I was really sick. So I got through that week without drinking anyway, and I went back to that Saturday night meeting, and they right away gave me a coffee commitment. Oh my God, you should have seen me. Letting me make your coffee is really scary. First of all, I was huge. I was obese. I didn't shower. I was missing my front teeth. I would fall asleep. I tried to bleach my hair, so I had blonde hair, and I would fall asleep with the bleach on my hair. So I had bald spots, orange blonde bleached hair. And then the last 2 months, I didn't bleach at all, so I had big black roots. I wore this big purple serape, so you couldn't see me, I didn't think. And they were just so kind to me about, I made the best coffee they ever had. And I didn't have a car for the first 5 years of sobriety. I'd have to go and buy all this stuff for the meeting, get on a bus, because I didn't have enough self-worth to ask for a ride. But they always gave me a ride home. Anyway, so I'm 6 months sober. I'm on my ninth step. My sponsor told me I had to get a job. I have to be fully supporting through my own contributions. I don't know how to work. I went out there and I got that first job, and my sponsor gave me permission to lie on my application because I couldn't get a job because I didn't have a high school diploma. And so she said she thought God's law was higher than man's law, and she said she thought it was all right with God if I lied on my application. So I lied on my application. I said I had a high school diploma. I added 2 years of college. And I got that job. And I worked there full-time for 8 years. I stayed on another 2 years part-time after I took another full-time position. When I left that job, I'd worked myself up to assistant administrator. In that first eight-year period, I went back to school. I couldn't pass a GED. They didn't have those classes. I had to go back to high school. I graduated from high school in 1985, and I was 36 years old, and I graduated with a cap, a gown, a real ceremony, 450 18-year-olds. They were incorrigible, so they went to night school, so I just fit right in with them. So what I did for the next 6 years is I went to work for a musical theater, and it was equity, and equity means union. And union means they dealt with big, big major stars. I started out in the bottom in the accounting department. I went back to school, and within a period of time, I worked myself up to business manager of this multi-million dollar corporation. And as business manager, I dealt with millions of dollars. Honest to God, when I got to this program, I didn't have a clue how many zeros were in $1 million. I have participated in union negotiations. I've been invited into some of the homes of the most famous people even today you see on stage, screen, and TV. Even today, I can see myself in a picture with a famous person, and I still get overwhelmed. I still think, how did I ever get from the gutters of Long Beach to be invited into some of these places? And how that happened is I worked the last part of that 12th step, and I applied these principles in all my affairs. Last story is how I came to terms with my God and my daughter's kidnap. I told you I had so much trouble with that sentence in the big book, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake, even though I had a relationship with God. And I sponsored this girl who had something more tragic happen to her than my daughter's. And she said to me, well, it must be God's will, because in the big book it says absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. I just went off on her like a crazy woman, and I yelled at her that that wasn't written by the first 100 alcoholics. It's not in the first 164 pages of the big book. I took the big book, I slammed it down, I said it's not even in the first two editions of this book. And I made this woman cry. She had these huge crocodile tears coming out of her eyes. And I knew right then and there that I had a problem, that I have a resentment about something in the big book. And this resentment's not only hurting me, now this resentment was hurting other people. So I came to a place of really being willing to give it up. That's all I could do, was be willing. And I prayed for God to help me with that sentence for a long time. And what finally happened for me, I was in a meeting with my sponsor, Polly, about this size, and she was sharing about a tape out by Clancy, and it's called Alcoholism, Disease of Perception. And right in that meeting, I had the biggest spiritual encounter I've ever had. I couldn't hear another word Polly said. Everything was like a white fog. But I had this inner voice, and it said, Michael, you know what happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is part of God's world. What happens when you work those 12 steps is part of God's world. The progression of all good is part of God's world. What happened in that car at that time, it was 9 years ago, what happened in that car 9 years ago was part of man's world. And right then, I was able to separate man's world from God's world, and I was able to come to terms with that sentence. And I can tell you today, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake, because it's God's world that got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. 2 weeks after I had that spiritual experience through a real weird series of coincidences, I found myself sitting down having dinner with a group of alcoholics, and I was sitting right next to Dr. Paul. And Dr. Paul is the one that wrote that sentence in the big book. And I was at such peace, I did not have to go off on him and tell him and tell him exactly what I thought about that sentence. Because I knew at that point it didn't matter what he meant when he wrote that sentence. What mattered was how I perceived it. And sometimes I have to work on my perception, because whatever that perception is, it has to work in my life. And I have to tell you, he became my spiritual advisor. And what he told me about that sentence, he's heard me talk a lot of times. We've talked at a lot of conventions together. What he told me is he did not mean anything like that when he wrote that sentence. He was not thinking of man's inhumanity of man. He said my spiritual experience was the best explanation he could think of as to why evil exists in this world. And I'm so thankful I paid attention to something I read in the 12 and 12. It said restraint of pen and tongue. Because when I found out this man was alive, I used to think everybody was dead in the big book. When I found out this man was alive, I cannot tell you how many countless times I sat down to write him some constructive criticism, which today I know would have been a hate letter. And if I'd followed through on sending it, I would never have had this gift because he became a gift in my life. And he used to get lots of letters about that sentence and lots of phone calls about that sentence, all from people who have suffered tragedies. And what he started doing is just giving them my phone number. He kept me real busy. We lost him a while ago, but when I talk about him, I feel his spirit, and I really miss him. Thank you. Oh.